We're in section B, verse 4 to verse 10, in which Krishna's Veda-abhed relationship with the material world is being briefly described. So we got up, I think, to verse 6 yesterday. So the basic idea expressed in verses 4 and 5 is that everything is within Krishna, but it's not within Krishna. Sort of like everything is Krishna, but it's not Krishna at the same time. So this is Veda-abhed. Of course, it's rather achintya at the same time. It's rather inconceivable. But there are a few ways that we can think about this situation in order to understand it a little more clearly. So the idea, basic idea, or one basic idea is like the energy and the energetic. The energy cannot really be separated from the energetic, but at the same time it's not exactly that the energy and the energetic are precisely the same in all regards. There is oneness there, a qualified type of oneness, but whether there's also some difference. Just like, well, one example that Prabhupada would give is the example of the sun and the sunshine. The sunshine is coming from the sun, so here outside we can see the sun shining. So when you see the sun shining, then you know, oh, there's the sun. It's a sunny day. The sun is there. But it's not exactly that the sun is just right immediately outside, or that the sun is coming in, if some beams of sunlight are coming in through the window, that that is actually the sun. But at the same time, you can't separate it from the sun. Wherever there is sun, there's sunshine. Just like wherever there's fire, there's heat and light. You don't get fire without heat and light. Heat and light are inherent qualities of fire. But the fire may be at the other end of the room, and the heat and light, they may be at this end of the room. So you can't, even though the heat and light are not separable from the fire, but still you can see, oh yes, there's the fire over there, and I'm standing here at some distance from it, and I'm standing and experiencing the heat and light. So it's one and different. And this is how Krishna is explaining things here. If you take away the sun, then there's no sun rays. If you take away the fire, there's no heat and there's no light. At the same time, wherever there's heat and light, you know, oh yes, fire is here. And wherever you see the sunlight, you know, oh yes, the sun is around at least. So this is one and different, the idea of energy and energetic. The idea of Brahman and Bhagavan is also very similar. What is Brahman? What is the Brahmajyoti? Well, it's a rather technical subject, actually. It's not quite the same as the light bulb and the light coming, not quite the same. We understand that actually the Brahman is Krishna himself. But he's not manifesting his form and he's not manifesting his personality. That's explained in Srimad Bhagavatam in the second chapter of the first canto, verse 11. Any of you know that verse? Brahman Paramatman. Very nice. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So these three features of the absolute truth, or not exactly that, but they are the absolute truth in three features. There's a difference. They're not three features of the absolute truth, but they are the absolute in three features. Bhagavan is the complete feature. He includes Paramatma and Brahman. Paramatma is a partial feature who includes Brahman but doesn't include Bhagavan. And Brahman is a partial feature which doesn't include Bhagavan and also doesn't include Paramatma. In that verse, the word advayagya is used. Non-dual knowledge. Non-dual means not two, and certainly not three or four or many. Not two, but one. The one absolute truth is known in these three features. So Brahman is Krishna, but simply Krishna is not manifesting his form, and he's not manifesting his personality. So, in this way, it is Krishna, but it's not Krishna. It is Krishna. You can't say it's something else. Wherever you've got the Brahman, you know Krishna is there. You can't separate the two. But still, it's not exactly Krishna in a complete manifestation. And then again in verse 6, the example of the relationship between the wind and the sky was given. The wind is in the sky or in space, but it's not mixing with that space. So it's in it, but it's not in it at the same time. So this is, of course, it is actually a little achintya. So these things which are achintya, they do tend to remain a little bit achintya also. But hopefully we can get a little bit of the idea. So Krishna goes on in verses 7, 8, 9 and 10 to give some examples of this achintya bade abade relationship that he has with the material creation. So in 7 he's explaining that it's all coming from his nature, from his potency. 8 is expressing another sort of achintya feature of this whole situation. He says that under my will, it's automatically happening. This is also a nice idea. So it's happening by his will, but it's happening automatically. If you've got something which is happening automatically, like a machine is ticking, an engine is just running, something like that. So it's not that every time the engine moves that you are there or the driver is there making it move. It's happening automatically. But it's not exactly simply happening automatically. It is working. The whole process has been begun by a person, by the will of a person. And for the process to continue on, the will of the person has to be there, otherwise the engine will stop sooner or later if it runs out of petrol, or maybe it'll break down. So it is being supervised, but if you look at it, you see, oh, it's just going on automatically. So it's bade abade. Automatic, but it's not totally automatic. It's going on under Krishna's will. And in verse 9, Krishna expresses it very nicely. He uses the word udasin vat, as neutral. And Prabhupada translates that in the verse that I'm ever detached from the material activity, from all these material activities, seated as though neutral. Now this may sound like we're getting a little sort of over-wordy, too much into word juggling. It's not actually word juggling, but we're trying to get a few definitions here. Krishna is saying that I am detached, but then he says that I'm seated as though neutral. He does not say that I am seated neutrally. He says that I am seated as though neutral. In other words, he's not really neutral, but it really does seem that he is. In fact, it's hard to say, is he neutral or not? But actually, he is involved. But his involvement is very subtle. And it's very much behind the scenes. Like the idea of the string of pearls, the relationship between the string and the pearls. It's a subtle relationship. You don't see it very easily, but it is there. And verse 10 also, it expresses it quite nicely. Maya adyakshena prakriti. Adyaksha means, or adyakshena means, under my eyes. Literally, adyaksha means under the eyes. So this material nature, Krishna is saying, which is one of my energies, is working under my eyes, under my direction. I'm ever detached, as though neutral, but it's going on under my eyes, automatically, but by my will. So it's like that. A little achintya, but there's definitely a subtle relationship. And if Krishna were to ever actually withdraw himself and give up his contact with the material nature would cease to function and everything would fall to pieces. But Krishna is not, like, involved, working hard, holding the material world together. As Prabhupada said, Krishna doesn't have to go to the office every morning to report in for work, keep this material world together. He doesn't have to do that. He just has a good time. He enjoys himself. But still it's going on under his supervision, under his eyes. Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur gives a very nice example. He gives the example of Maharaj Ambarish. Maharaj Ambarish, he was a great devotee. And he was always absorbed in Krishna conscious activity, chanting and hearing about Krishna, worshipping Krishna. And he didn't really bother getting involved in all the details of the management of his kingdom. But the kingdom was working perfectly. Because everyone knew that the king is there, simply because of his presence. Even though he wasn't really getting involved in it very actively. But just because of his presence, everything was working very, very nicely. And if he'd left the kingdom, it wouldn't have just gone on so nicely. That going on very nicely was actually dependent on his presence. So, now we go on to section C. Talking about non-worshippers, non-devotees, and worshippers or devotees. So verse 11 is a well-known verse. Avajananti mam mudha. The mudhas, or the ass-like people. People who are really fools. They don't accept Krishna when he appears in the human form. They have so many ideas about Krishna. They think that, yes, Krishna is there, and Krishna is this tall. You know, maybe he's about the same size as me, or something like that. He's occupying this much space, and he's living, he appeared at a certain time, and we assume that he'll go out of existence after some time, just like us. So why should we take it that Krishna's any different from us? But this is a big mistake, a very serious mistake they make, thinking that Krishna's just one of us. They don't understand that form, this is the important point, that form of Krishna is the absolute truth. In the seventh chapter, there was one verse in which Krishna was saying that the abuddhaya, people who have no brain, they think that I was impersonal before, now I've assumed a personality, and when my body is finished, at the end of the life of this body, then again I'll return to my natural, impersonal state. But Krishna said there that this is an indication of their being abuddhaya. They have no intelligence. Not just alpamedasa, like the demigod worshippers, small intelligence, but Abhudaya. So here it's the same idea, that little form of Krishna, or like here on the walls we have a number of pictures of Krishna. So Krishna, like here next to Bhakta Mark, under the light, is Gopal Krishna. So we may think, oh yes, it's a nice little picture of Krishna, maybe it's 18 inches high and a few inches wide and it's been printed on a piece of paper and that's what it is. But no, Krishna is here. Krishna's here in person. And when we say Krishna, we mean the absolute truth. That within this form of Gopal Krishna printed supposedly in ink on paper, everything, the entire spiritual and material creation, including us in our little corner of the material creation, everything is within Krishna here. Now you may say, no, no, no. How can it be? But it's a fact. That little, any form of, bona fide form of Krishna is the complete absolute truth. Not just a representation, not something like that. A pastime of Krishna's which illustrates that very clearly is the Damodar Leela. You know, in the Damodar Leela, Mother Yasoda was trying to tie Krishna to a grinding mortar. And first of all, she got one piece of rope, she felt it would be big enough. But it wasn't. Two fingers too short. Then she got another and another. Eventually she got all the rope in the village. That wasn't enough. And, you know, that's quite a lot of rope. Then she got all the rope in all the villages in the whole Vraj Mandala. But still it was two fingers too short. So why? Why is that? Is it just that Krishna is putting on a mystical display, playing like a mystical game with it? No. Actually, what the situation is that little form of baby Krishna is the absolute truth. And the summum bonum of everything. So how much rope do you need to tie around everything in existence? Well, you can't do it. What to speak of all the rope in Vraj Mandala? Even all the rope on this planet, all the rope in this universe, all the rope in all the material universes wouldn't be enough. So it appears that, oh yes, just a little baby boy is this big and, you know, he cries and plays around. But actually, that is the absolute truth. And that is ultimately why Mother Yasoda couldn't get the rope around Krishna's body. But when Mother Yasoda became more and more anxious in love for Krishna, then Krishna was forced to allow her to tie that rope around her. And then she wouldn't have needed all the rope in Vraj Mandala. Even that first piece of rope would have been enough. Because Krishna, because of her devotion, he surrendered to her. And we know actually that in the end, of that pastime when Krishna delivered Nalakurva and Manigriva. Nalakurva and Manigriva were standing there offering prayers to Krishna that you have delivered us and you're the Supreme Lord and you're so great and you're so wonderful. But then they noticed that, oh, you're tied up to a grinding mortar. What happened? So they thought, well, this is not very nice. This is God tied up to a grinding mortar. We better untie him. So they tried to untie him, but they couldn't. Then Krishna tried to untie himself, but he couldn't. It was only when Mother Yasoda came, and she was able to untie Krishna. So actually, Krishna was bound by the ropes of love, not just bound by some few feet of rope or even a few miles of rope, but he was bound by Mother Yasoda's love. So this is the nature of the form of Krishna. But here in this verse, Krishna is talking about people who don't understand that fact. Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur says that if you don't understand the transcendental nature, the real transcendental nature of Krishna's body, then even if you're a devotee, you won't be successful. Even if you're a karmi, doing all your duties very perfectly to go to Swarga, to go to heaven, you won't be successful. If you're a jnani trying to merge into the Brahmajyoti, but you disrespect Krishna's form, you won't be successful. Actually, you'll go to hell. Even if you're a strict follower of Varnashram, but you disrespect Krishna's form, you'll go to hell. And that is made quite clear in the next verse, verse 12. Krishna says that people who are holding these different wrong ideas about Krishna's, about his own body, thinking that it's material, thinking that he's just some sort of mystic who performed some austerities in his previous lifetime, and now he's got some special abilities. So people like who think like that, then Krishna says that they become attracted to demonic and atheistic views. Somehow or other, they just become impelled towards demonic and atheistic views. Rakshasi and Asuri. Rakshasi means mode of ignorance. They become very violently inclined. Mode of ignorance. And Asuri means mode of passion. They become very attached to lusty activities. So this is what happens. They lose their discrimination because of disrespecting Krishna's form. Verses 13 and 14 describe the nice qualities of the devotees who do appreciate Krishna's form. That they are placed under the direction of the spiritual nature, particularly because they've accepted the spiritual nature of Krishna's body. Therefore, they are ananya manaso. This word ananya we've come across already a few times, we'll come across it again. Means undeviating. Their minds are undeviatingly fixed on Krishna. And they're understanding Krishna's position very nicely. And so what do? Verse 14 explains. They become inspired to always glorify Krishna, always serve Krishna, offer respect to him, serve him wholeheartedly. Why? Because they've appreciated his form, the transcendental position of the Supreme Lord. Then in verse 15, Krishna mentions three other categories of persons. The Ekatvena, Pritaktvena, and Bahuda Vishvatomukha. Ekatvena means the monists. Eka means one. Those who feel themselves to be one with the Supreme. Pritaktvena refers to many like demigod worshippers, people like that. They concoct. They imagine that someone is God. Someone who's not God, they think, oh, he must be God. Shiva's God, Brahma's God, Durga's God, Hanuman is God, Kalima is God. Someone is God. But actually that person is not. So that's Pritaktvena. And Bahuda Vishvatomukha means people who worship the universal form. Going on to section D, verses 16 to 25, the first four verses are describing the practices of the Bahuda Vishvatomukham, those people who are worshipping the universal form. These are all different features of the universal form. The Kratu, the Yajna. Kratu means the strict Vedic sacrifice. Yajna means a more Puranic type of Smriti sacrifice, Prabhupada says. They're divisions within the Vedas. So Kratu refers to the strict Vedic sacrifices from the four Vedas. Yajna refers to the sacrifices from Smriti Shastra, or the Puranas, Itihasas. So Krishna goes on 16, 17, 18, and 19. describing different features of the universal form, which are worshipped by these Bahuda Vishvatomakam. Of course, at the same time, in terms of how Krishna has explained things in the seventh chapter, Maya Sakta Mana, that our minds should be attached to him, we can also appreciate these four verses as giving us further ideas about how we can appreciate Krishna's presence around us. So it can also be helpful like that. Then verses 20 to 25 are going back to the subject of demigod worship. Verse 22 is a special verse. We'll speak about that a little separately. But otherwise, from 20 to 25 is discussing again demigod worship. So in 20, Krishna is saying about how people may follow different Vedic practices and be elevated to Indraloka. He says they're purified of sinful reactions because they have followed the Vedic rules and regulations. Baladev Vijayabhushan makes the point that this does not mean that they've actually become purified of all sinful reactions, like a devotee. Not like that. But he says what it means is they've become purified of those sinful reactions which would take them to hell. They're free of those, but it's not that they're actually free of all sinful reactions. Verse 21 explains how they eventually fall down again. Now, if they were purified of all sinful reactions, how would they fall down? They wouldn't fall down. But they're not purified of all sinful reactions. Our acharyas explain, Baladev Vijayabhushan, he explains that just before they finish all their pious reactions, while there's still a little bit of piety left, then they fall down. So then they may be born in a situation on this planet or a similar planet, a situation on in this type of this part of the material realm, which is very nice. Or they may manifest some particular qualifications because they've still got a little bit of their good reactions left. Prabhupada, as an example, he gave the Beatles as an example. Prabhupada said they were musicians in the heavenly planets. But then when there was just a little bit of their pious reactions left, they fell down. But they still had a little bit there. So, you know, by our standards, they were quite exceptional. They were very clever. They were very fortunate. But slowly they burnt up that little bit of remaining good karma. John Lennon, I think, was the first one to do that. Any of you who are familiar with the Beatles will know what I mean. So he got heavily involved in sinful activity, John Lennon, more heavily than the others. And he ran out of his good karma and he was killed. So it's like that. Or someone like Mozart, at a very young age, he was coming up with all sorts of beautiful musical compositions. From where? Was coming from his previous lifetime and from that little bit of good karma he still had left. So anyway, then they come down and then they have to more or less start again. Now I said verse 22 is very important. It is very important. Krishna, starting here and going on till about verse 11 of the 10th chapter, Krishna is going to reveal some very important secrets about bhakti yoga. And an important point. Krishna says that I carry to them what they lack. So what do you lack? You lack what you are not due according to your karma. It's not that you're going to be lacking something, but actually you're due it. Lacking in that sense. No. If any living being is lacking anything, for their happy existence in life generally. It's simply their karma, isn't it? It's not that whimsically someone has been deprived of something, so now they're lacking. No. So Krishna says that even if, according to your karma, the devotee, even if you're due to be lacking something, but I'll carry it to you. And I preserve what you have. What things might you have which would need to be preserved? Things which, according to your karma, you are due to lose. Those things, they would need to be preserved. Otherwise, if according to your karma, you're due to have those things, then you don't need to worry about preserving them. But Krishna is saying that even if according to your karma, you're due to lose something, I'll preserve it for you. So Krishna is actually interfering here with the laws of karma for his devotee, out of love. So Krishna is really expressing something from his heart. Because of his feelings of love, he's doing like that. Otherwise, if you're practicing karma yoga, jnana yoga, ashtanga yoga, chakra yoga, or any other yoga, then you just follow the process and you get what you deserve. But not if you're a devotee. No. Krishna involves himself very deeply. So we'll see this more in a few verses. But this is an important statement here in this verse. There's one very interesting story, I know some of you have heard of it, told by Srila Prabhupada, about one Brahmin who would read this verse. He would read Bhagavad Gita every day, but when he came to this verse, he would become confused. Because here Krishna says, Vahami Aham, which means that I personally carry and deliver. Personally, Vahami Aham, that I in person do this. So this Brahmin became confused that Krishna is so great, he's God. He couldn't personally come and do like a door-to-door delivery here to his devotee. Here, you take this from his hand. No. So he thought that this word Vahami must not be correct. More suitable would be the word Karomi. Karomi means that I cause it to happen. Krishna is the supreme controller, so he may cause it that you get this and get that and so on. So this Brahmin was thinking like this. So therefore he took his leaf, Bhagavad Gita was handwritten on leaves, and he actually scratched it off the leaf, physically removed it. He didn't just ink over it. He actually scratched it away from the leaf, and he wrote in that place, Karomi. And he thought, very nice. Then, well, he was a very poor Brahmin. Then he had to go out and beg food for lunch, he and his wife. They would just live on what he could beg every day. So while he was out, there was a knock on the door. And one little boy was there with a big basket of vegetables and all sorts of food. And the wife asked, what's this? What's happening? And the boy said, well, I saw your husband. He was begging for food and I felt sorry for him. So here, I brought some for you. So the wife took it and she was very thankful, and the boy turned around to walk away. And she noticed that on his back, some say on his back, some say on his forehead, but anyway, somewhere, there were some nasty cuts which were bleeding. And she asked him, oh, what happened? And the boy said, well, you might be surprised to hear this, but your husband did this to me. And she said, no, no, he would never do that. Why did he do that? And he said, well, you should ask him when he gets back. It was a very wrong thing that he did. Not very nice. So then the boy went and the husband returned a little while later. And he said he wasn't successful in getting any food. So he told his wife, I guess we're going to have to fast today. And his wife said, no, no, I'm cooking a big feast. With all those things that little boy brought, you remember? What little boy? You know that boy, the one you hit him on the back and you cut his back in such an unkind way? And the husband was bewildered. So I didn't meet anybody. I would never do a thing like that. He said, yes, yes. He showed me. You cut him on his back. It was very nasty. And he was trying to figure out what on earth is going on. And then as he was thinking, his eyes fell to his table where this leaf was lying, where he scratched out the word Vahami and written Karomi. And suddenly it clicked that that was Krishna. And he personally carried to us what we needed, what we were lacking. So then he fell down at his wife's feet and said, you're such a great devotee. Krishna personally came and appeared before you. And I'm such a rascal that all I could do is cause him pain. So then he scratched out Karomi and wrote Vahami in again. And then he went dancing around, singing Vahami, Vahami. No one could understand quite what he was doing. But he was very inspired. So it's like that. So here, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Arjuna asks a question that your devotee is allowing Krishna. Because your devotee is so busy serving Krishna, he's got no time to look after himself. So indirectly, he's forcing Krishna to serve him. So is this not a sign of a lack of Krishna consciousness? Surely he should take a little time out from his service and look after himself. But then Krishna says to Arjuna, no, I don't feel it to be a burden. I enjoy doing it. I want to do it. I want to look after my devotee. Just like a father, he's providing for his family. He doesn't feel that, oh, what a burden. He wants to do it. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives a very vivid example to illustrate the point, to illustrate Krishna's feelings, because this is coming from Krishna's heart. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, it's just like a young boy, a young man, who has a young girlfriend. So they have that, you know, some sort of affectionate type of relationship. So they're walking together, and they come to one river. And the girl says to the boy, will you pick me up and carry me across? And the boy, he's very happy to do it. The boy doesn't think that, oh, you're so heavy. Why should I carry you? Why can't you walk across like me? No. Actually, he's looking for opportunities to have that sort of exchange with her. He's looking for opportunities. So he says this is the mood of Krishna, that he wants to do things like this. He's looking for opportunities to serve his devotees. So this is a very intimate mood that Krishna is expressing here. That whatever the laws of karma may be, whatever my devotee is due according to those laws, that doesn't matter. But I am now dealing with my devotee. So that's a very nice thing. So then Krishna goes on, verses 23 and 24, to again sort of blast the demigod worshippers. They're worshipping the demigods. Actually, they're really worshipping me. But they're doing it avidipurvakam, in a wrong way. They're doing the wrong thing. And verse 24, because they're doing the wrong thing, what happens? They fall down. They fall down. So if you're preaching to Indian people, you should remember these verses and the verses of the seventh chapter, because they make it very clear that demigod worship is really not correct. People will simply end up falling down. And verse 25, he's explaining that my devotees will come to me. Other people will go wherever they deserve to go, but my devotees will come to me. And that means eternal life, full of bliss and knowledge. Now the last section is a very important section. Krishna is really, he expresses a number of very nice sentiments about his devotees. In verse 26, well, there are three subsections, you see. First is that it's such a simple process. but the result is incomparable. Second section, subsection is that Krishna favors his devotees, and when we discuss how much he favors his devotees, I think many of you will be quite amazed at what Krishna says. And third subsection is that there, no one is disqualified. Anyone has full opportunity. Everyone has full opportunity to get this highest benefit through devotional service. So the first subsection is verses 26 to 28. Such a simple process, but such a wonderful result. So verse 26, I'm sure you've all heard of this verse. Krishna says, you can offer me just one leaf, just one flower, just one fruit, just a little water, if that's all you can afford, if that's all you're able. It doesn't have to be extravagant if you're not able to provide something very substantial. Even one leaf will be enough. You know the story of Sanatana Goswami and Madan Mohan, I suppose. When Sanatana Goswami first, Madan Mohan sort of presented himself to Sanatana Goswami, Madan Mohan was being looked after very nicely by a very nice Brahmin family in Mathura. They are providing him with very nice food and everything. And Sanatana said that, I can't provide you with such things. I live on practically nothing. But Madan Mohan was saying, no, I want to come with you. I want to come with you and travel around Vraja. So I don't mind. Even if it's just dry chapatis, I'll accept it. So after a while, Sanatana, he'd been offering dry chapatis every day. After a while, Madan Mohan said, you know, I've been getting dry chapatis every day for so long now. Can't you do a little better? And Sanatana said, I knew you'd complain eventually. So I'm going to take you back to that family in Mathura. And they'll feed you very nicely. But Madan Mohan said, no. It's all right. I want to stay with you, so I'll accept whatever you offer. So it's like that. Krishna wants the bhakti, actually. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that ideally, the leaf, you know, like the vegetables, the flowers, the fruits, they should all be planted by devotees, grown by devotees, harvested by devotees. They should definitely be cooked by devotees and offered by devotees. Ideally. Of course, that's, I would say, generally not possible. So Prabhupada said that if at least you pay the price, if you buy it in the market, that sort of takes care of the karma that may be involved in how it was grown and so on, by if it was prepared or grown by karmis. But definitely we should stay clear of food which is cooked by devotees. I think I mentioned earlier on that Prabhupada said that if you eat grains which have been cooked by non-devotees, then your mind becomes wicked. It's very dangerous. Now, in verse 27, one other point. This verse 26 is one of three verses in this chapter which Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur says are very advanced verses. The other verses are 14 and 22. So 14, 22 and 26, according to Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, are very advanced verses. Now the next verse, 27, is like a step down. Arjuna is thinking that he says to Krishna, I don't know if I can come to such a high level immediately. I'd like to, but I don't know if I could do it right now, just right, like on the spot. So Krishna then speaks this verse. And this verse, you might think that this is like Nishkam Karma Yoga. Or you might think, actually it's more like Sakam Bhakti Yoga. So there's a very interesting discussion between Krishna and Arjuna right here. I won't go through the entire thing. But Arjuna protests that, can't I be considered to be performing pure devotional service? He says that I fast on Ekadasi. If I ever do any sacrifice, it's always for Vishnu. And these are all part of bhakti. But Krishna says that you are doing these things out of duty. You're doing them, then you're offering them. Now if you do them, if you do your duty and then offer you the results of your duty, that's nishkam, karma yoga. But if you just do things, not because they're duty, you just do things because you feel like you want to serve Krishna in that way, then this is sakam bhakti yoga. Because you're not acting according to your duty. Therefore it can't be considered karma yoga. But you're acting in the way that you want to act in relationship with Krishna. So therefore it is sakam. Do you follow? I hope you follow. I mean, it's all a little subtle. We could go into it more deeply, and it gets even more subtle. But this is the basic idea. That when you're doing your duty according to your varnashram position, this is karma yoga. But when you're acting not according to your duty, but because you feel inspired to act in that way, and you're doing it for Krishna, then this is not part of karma yoga. This is actually part of bhakti yoga. But it's sakam, because you're acting in terms of your own feelings, rather in terms of what Krishna wants, like a clear idea of what Krishna actually wants, then it would become nishkam bhakti yoga. So Krishna, the point is there that in karma yoga, you act and you offer the result. But in bhakti yoga, it's a very interesting point. In bhakti yoga, the offering starts with, guess what? What does the offering begin with? Yeah, but the offering begins with you. You offer yourself. And when you're offered, this is a rather interesting concept, but when you're offered to Krishna, then you're simply acting for Krishna. There's no question of anything un-Krishna conscious, because you're offered to Krishna. But in karma yoga, there's you and you think, yes, I have my duty and I must do it and it's my duty, and then I'll offer it. It's mine and I'm offering it. So wherever there is the idea of offering, in other words, that something is separate from Krishna, but now we're presenting it here, Krishna, you can have it now. There's a danger of it not really being bhakti. Because bhakti means that everything is connected. We're perceiving everything as being connected with Krishna, which is true. Everything is connected with Krishna. And rather than exactly offering it, here, Krishna, you can have it now. It was mine or it was someone else's, but now you can have it. No, we're just acknowledging that Krishna, it's yours. It is yours, so here, you enjoy it. In that sense, offering in that sense. So, Krishna, he actually explains like this. In pure devotional service, you simply act for my pleasure. You don't really offer anything. But here in karma yoga, you perform your activities and then you offer. So in bhakti, the devotee is already, the actor is already offered. And this is like the fundamental difference between karma yoga and bhakti yoga. So Krishna says, whatever you do, just whatever you do, whatever you may feel like doing, not whatever your duty is, not that, but whatever you just do, whatever you happen to eat, according to how you feel like eating, whatever you may give in charity or give away, not according to your duty, but just because you want to, you do that for me. So you're doing those things because you want to, therefore it's sakam. But because it's not being done in terms of varnashram and your duty according to your varna and so on, it can be considered a part of bhakti, although it's still sakam, due to the fact that you're acting on your own inspiration. And if you do like this, verse 28, Krishna says, if you do like this, then you'll become purified, you'll come to me. So it'll be very good for you, Arjuna. In our cases, we should act according to the instructions of the spiritual master. Now we go on to the second subsection, verses 29 to 31. 29 is another important verse. There's a very subtle point to be understood here. That very subtle point is that the first two lines of this verse, Samoham Sarvabhuteshu na me dveshosti na priyaha, which translates as, I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone, I'm equal to all. This is referring to the supersoul. This is how the supersoul acts. But when Krishna says, Ye bhajanti tamam bhaktya, mai te teshu chapyaham, but whoever renders service unto me in devotion as a friend is in me, and I'm also a friend to him. Here Krishna is talking about himself, Bhagavan, and how he relates to his devotees. In other words, the supersoul is simply giving everyone whatever they deserve, good, bad, whatever it may be. He doesn't, if someone is suffering because he has given them some suffering, it doesn't indicate that he dislikes them. It's just their karma, and he's overseeing it. And if someone is enjoying materially, it doesn't indicate that he's favoring them. He's simply seeing that they get their karma. But Krishna, as Bhagavan, Krishna, because Paramatma doesn't really have like personal relationships, but Krishna as Bhagavan, he definitely has personal relationships. So Krishna takes this position of being a friend to his devotees. And how does he do that? Verse 30 explains extremely vividly. This is Krishna's making such a strong point here. It's practically astonishing. Even if one commits the most abominable action, if he's engaged in devotional service, he must be considered saintly because he's properly situated in his determination. So Krishna says, Sudaracha. Acha means activity. Duracha means bad activity. And Sudaracha means extremely bad, abominable. In Ramanujacharya's commentary on Bhagavad Gita, he expresses it that even if a person acts in a way which is exceedingly wicked, very strong language, exceedingly wicked, but as long as he's ananya bhak, as long as he's fully engaged in devotional service, then sadur eva, he must be considered saintly. Now, of course, it's very important to grasp the idea that Krishna is saying that only as long as that person is ananya bhak, undeviatingly engaged. If the person does something abominable and then leaves Krishna consciousness and is no longer engaged in devotional service, then you don't consider them saintly. But if a person remains engaged in devotional service, then even if they commit the most abominable action, you must consider them saintly. There's a very interesting exchange between Krishna and Arjuna here, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakura. Arjuna protests that, you know, how is it possible? If he's Sudaracha, it can't really be possible. When someone's engaged in devotional service, he's a sadhu, of course, but not when he's a nonsense, not when he's engaged in some maya. And Krishna says, no, That's not correct. Because of his determination, Ananyaba, determination to serve, I keep him as a sadhu. Because he's resolved to serve, despite his weaknesses. But then Arjuna protests further that I can understand that we might not kick him out. I mean, we might kick him out, but we might not kick him out. But to consider him a saint, I can't accept it. And Krishna gets a little angry. And Krishna says, no, I keep him as a sadhu. I keep him as a sadhu. And Krishna explains that this devotee laments. He says, he laments remembering Krishna again and again. Because of his lamentation, his heart burns and he becomes purified through that burning fire of lamentation and remorse. He thinks, alas, alas, there's no other devotee like me. I'm a black spot amongst the devotees. Again and again he curses himself. So because of this lamentation he becomes purified. And then Krishna speaks verse 31. Shipram Bhavati. He speaks the first two lines of verse 31. Shipram Bhavati Dharmatma. Shashvash Chantam Nagachati. He quickly becomes righteous through this lamentation and like that. But then Arjuna protests again that I can't really accept it. How's it possible? What? Then Arjuna says, what about if he remains a Sudurachari for the rest of his life? While still engaged in devotional service somehow or other at the same time. So what happens then? And then Krishna's eyes become red with anger. And he shouts at Arjuna, Kanteya Pratijanihi, Name Bhakta Pranashati, that my devotee will never perish. And I want you to declare it. Arjuna becomes frightened. He says, all right. I'll accept it. But how are other people going to accept it? Then Krishna tells him, Kanteya Pratijani, you go and tell them. He says, you take drums and cartels and you go to the marketplace and you stand up on an elevated place and you declare to everyone that people understand that Krishna's devotee never perishes. And when you've gathered them all together, then you go to a place where there are some people who are having a meeting, and just like you, they can't accept this point. And they're debating, what does Krishna mean? And you go right into the middle of that meeting with all the people from the marketplace, with your drums and cartels, and you break up the meeting. And you tell them, no, you're wrong. Krishna said, Name Bhakta Pranashati, that my devotee never perishes as long as the devotee is engaged in Ananya Bhakti. So unfortunately we have to end here. But tomorrow...